You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Mark McClellan. I'm the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform here at the Brookings Institution, and we're delighted today to be hosting another in our series of roundtable webinars. Today we've got a lot of ground to cover. We're going to provide an update on FDA's current active surveillance capabilities and the accomplishments that have occurred in their pilot mini Sentinel program in this area. These topics were some that were discussed at a big in-person meeting in Washington on January 12th, and we know that because we had a snowstorm that same day, a lot of people weren't able to make it to the Sentinel Initiative public workshop. And so we are covering some of that ground here for people who haven't seen it before. Also, this is going to provide an opportunity for some of our major presenters at that meeting to give a little bit of an update or some reflections that they've had based on the discussion there, and of course an opportunity for all of you to not only hear a recap of what was presented and where things are headed, but also to ask any follow-up questions or clarifications that you may have. As usual, today's roundtable is going to be an online web presentation. All of your lines should be automatically muted at this point, but if you could please confirm that your phone or computer is muted, that would be great to minimize any background noise. To mute your phone on this system, you simply press *6, so *6 to mute. To unmute your phone, press *7, *6 to mute, *7 to unmute. And we also encourage you to use the Q&A tab at the top of your screen for the web presentation to submit questions at any time during the presentations. We'll get them into the queue and get them organized, and we can get through them more efficiently that way. We'll call you to state your question, though, when we get to the questions, so please keep listening. At the end of the session, we're going to open up the lines for those of you who are participating only by phone to ask questions, too. And if you have any technical problems in the course of this web presentation, please call the Brookings IT Help Desk. That's at 202-797-6193. So let's get started to briefly go over the agenda for today. We're going to begin with Julie Rakusin, who's the Sentinel, Judy Rakusin, I'm sorry, is the Sentinel Initiative's lead scientist, and she's going to start with an overview of FDA's perspective on the project. Judy had a great presentation at the meeting on the wide range of activities and FDA's strategic outlook on the initiative, which Judy will summarize here. Rich Platt is then going to follow with a status report on Mini Sentinel. Then Leslie Curtis is going to cover in more detail the development of Mini Sentinel's distributed database. Then Devin McGraw is going to talk about how privacy and security in Mini Sentinel is being addressed, some very important issues for the general public. And then finally, Bruce Fireman is going to talk about plans for Mini Sentinel's first active surveillance protocol, some of the early application work with the program. After that, we're going to open up the lines for questions. The presentation materials from the webinar today are going to be posted on the Brookings website and FDA Sentinel Initiative website in the next few days. I want to emphasize that these are condensed materials from our January 12th public workshop, and those materials are also posted on the Brookings website. So we strongly encourage you to consult these resources if you have any questions. The resources include recently published New England Journal perspective piece co-authored by the FDA and Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare and Brookings that came out on the day of the public meeting. So all those more detailed materials are already available now. And then again, you can submit questions at any time during the presentations using the Q&A tab at the top of your screen. So with that, I'd like to turn to Judy Rakusin to start us off. And Judy, you may need to press *7 to unmute.
Can you hear me?
There you go. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. I'm happy to be here to introduce this mini Sentinel update and talk a little bit about FDA's efforts in the area of active surveillance and how we got to mini Sentinel. Next slide, please. So as many of you may know, the FDA Amendments Act of 2007 in Section 905 talked about the requirement that FDA establish a post-market risk identification and analysis system that would link and analyze safety data from multiple sources, with the goal of including 25 million people by July of last year and 100 million people by July of next year. And the goal was that we, in this system, we access a variety of sources, including both federal and private sector sources. There are little check marks by 25 million because we reached and exceeded that goal last summer, as was required. And check marks by each of the federal and private sector data sources because our pilot projects within the Sentinel Initiative include both of those. The next slide, please. So the Sentinel Initiative was launched by FDA in May of 2008 to respond to the congressional mandate that was in the FDA Amendments Act of 2007. And really the goals are improving FDA's capability to identify and evaluate safety issues in near real time and to enhance FDA's ability to evaluate safety issues that are not easily evaluated with the current systems that FDA had in place, which are primarily passive surveillance systems. Getting just back to the near real time issue for a moment, there is using these passive surveillance systems, there is a lag in the capability to evaluate particular issues, and so with this active surveillance approach, we hope that we can more quickly address the questions that are cropping up either during medical product development programs or during the marketing period. And with enhancing our ability to evaluate safety issues, that includes expanding our access to subgroups and special populations, longer-term data, and to be able to evaluate adverse events that generally occur commonly in the general population and are not easily evaluable in the passive surveillance systems because they don't tend to get reported. I want to emphasize that the Sentinel Initiative and ultimately the Sentinel system will augment and but not replace the existing safety monitoring systems. Next slide. So we have a couple of different pilots going on right now, but today I'm going to focus on Mini Sentinel because that's what we're hearing more about later. I'll also mention we have the Federal Partners Collaboration, which involves our federal colleagues at CMS, VA and DOD, we are having piloting active surveillance evaluations with that group, similar to the active surveillance evaluations that are being developed within Mini Sentinel. So moving on to Mini Sentinel, this is a contract that was awarded in the fall of 2009. And to Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare with the goal of developing the scientific operations that are needed for the Sentinel Initiative and ultimately the Sentinel system, really with the goals of creating a coordinating center that has continuous access to automated healthcare data systems and provide a laboratory for developing and evaluating scientific methodologies that might be later used in the Sentinel system, as well as offering the agency the capability of understanding what are some of the barriers and challenges involved in conducting active surveillance using automated healthcare data. The next slide, please. Now, there are a range of places that we could have initiated our efforts, and along the continuum of trying to understand safety issues with new medical products and marketed medical products include generating new safety signals, evaluating or refining safety signals that have emerged or sort of a later stage validation of signals that have emerged. And we're within Mini Sentinel initially focusing on signal refinement. So this is a scenario that encompasses a couple different scenarios that I just wanted to mention. So some of those would be, signal refinement is where we have a signal that has emerged, and we are interested in trying to understand whether there is additional evidence to support that particular association between the exposure and the outcome. So those could be concerns that emerge prior to marketing, either because they've been observed in a pre-market development program or because there's a theoretical concern because of the kind of medical product it is and that that category of medical product has had particular side effects that don't occur commonly but may be of theoretical concern. The second kind would be concerns that emerge after the product's been marketed for a period of time, and you want to have the capability to look back to see if there's evidence of a problem. With that, I'm going to stop and pass the podium on to my mini Sentinel colleagues.
Okay, Rich, are you there? Rich may need to push star 7. We don't hear you yet.
How about now?
There we go. Thanks.
Good. Good. Thanks very much. I'll take the next couple of minutes to highlight the things that we've done during this past year and to look ahead to the major things on our agenda for next year. We have concentrated our efforts in 8 kinds of activities. One is standing up a coordinating center. The second is developing governance and procedures and a set of accompanying principles and policies, developing privacy policies, which Devin will talk about, major effort in data development that Leslie will discuss, creating communications, methods development, and developing an active surveillance protocol that Bruce will discuss. The coordinating centers, the main message in the coordinating center is the existence of a planning board that has participation of all 26 organizations that constitute the Mini-Sentinel partnership, and that includes both the organizations that actively contribute data or expertise, and patient representatives, and an operations center which is based largely but not entirely at the Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. Let me focus on the first 3 of these principles and policies. The first is that after considerable deliberation, FDA determined that the activities of the Mini-Sentinel are public health practice, not research. And so Mini-Sentinel operates on behalf of FDA as in support of its public health mission. The second is a strong determination to minimize the transfer of protected health information and proprietary data through the use of distributed data analysis mechanisms that Leslie will describe. And the third is a commitment to making all of our work product available to the public, at least on the Mini-Sentinel website and by other mechanisms as well. And by work product, we mean the things shown here, tools, methods, protocols, computer programs, as well as the findings of our work. The partner organizations include the ones shown on this slide that contribute data as well as expertise. And we have focused initially on use of administrative and claims data from WellPoint, Kaiser, Humana, and the HMO Research Network, but the others on this slide will be contributing as time progresses. And then additional data partners that are contributing various kinds of expertise are shown on this slide. We have developed a FSMA-compliant portal for secure file transfer and storage, and we've also created a public website at www.minisentinel.org, and I'd invite you to take a look and give us advice about how we can make this be as useful as possible. But the kinds of things that are either there now or will be as the information becomes available are the results of completed evaluations, a statement about the ongoing and planned evaluations, methods and tools that we've developed, the policies and procedures that I alluded to, protocols and the actual computer programs that we use to check the quality of the data and to query the information. We've put a substantial amount of energy into developing both epidemiologic and statistical methods where we have seen gaps that pose particular barriers to many sentinels being able to fulfill the mission that FDA has given us. And so in epidemiology, that includes a taxonomy of study designs for different purposes and a series of literature reviews to determine the best algorithms available for using coded health data for 20 outcomes that FDA thinks are likely to be ones of substantial interest to it. And then three statistical methods development activities shown here, better adjustment for confounding case-based methods and development of better regression methods for sequential analysis. That puts us on the cusp of actually doing active surveillance. Bruce will describe the work that we plan to do in evaluating the risk of acute myocardial infarction related to oral hypoglycemics. But we're also planning this year to evaluate new safety issues that have arisen for older drugs and also to develop a framework for evaluating the impact of FDA's regulatory action on both on utilization and health outcomes. And then with the Center for Drugs, and with the Center for Biologics, we'll be standing up two active surveillance programs for vaccines, one looking at specific outcomes of the rotavirus vaccines that are on the market now, and the second looking at the human papillomavirus vaccines. So our take for the year's activities are that we've made a substantial amount of progress, and I think all in all we're quite pleased with the with our position at the moment. We're extremely mindful of the challenges that did face Mini Sentinel and continue to do that. I've listed them here, and I just want to share with you our sense that the things that we need always to be mindful of are the need for Mini Sentinel to provide timely information, both for detecting potential problems and for following up any signals that we identify, and also the importance of balancing the ability to detect problems or conditions that FDA wants to be notified of against the real downside of false alarms. And so those are issues that underline all of the work that we do. We have reasonable confidence that we'll be able to make a substantial contribution while keeping these things in mind. So that's the view from 10,000 feet. And now I think Leslie will take you down to a better view of how we're dealing with the data systems.
Great, thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Leslie, can you?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. Yep, we can hear you. Thanks. Go ahead.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to present on behalf of the people in Mini Sentinel, the data partners and the data core who've been working on this over the last year. If I were to force to summarize our accomplishments in just a few sentences, I'd say that we've built a really unique collaboration and rich data source among multiple data partners. We've created some tools that really allow us to access that resource rapidly and efficiently, and we're also beginning to use those tools to provide useful information to FDA. Over the next few minutes, I'll try to give you some understanding of how we've done that. So Mini Sentinel uses a distributed data approach in which the data partners maintain both physical and operational control over their electronic data and its uses. Because the data partners maintain this control, that model avoids or in many cases reduces some of the security and privacy concerns that would normally arise. Now, the foundation of a distributed approach is a common data model that establishes uniform definitions of the different data entities. What I'll do next is talk briefly about the steps that led to the creation of the mini-Sentinel common data model. We began by laying the groundwork, if you will, in the form of some guiding principles. As with everything that I'll describe today, we arrived at these principles over many conference calls, email exchanges, and individual conversations. There are 11 guiding principles in all, and none is more important than the other, but I've highlighted some on this slide that really lay out some of the broadly stated principles. The first bullet really speaks to the centrality of the data partners in the process. They not only bring data resources, but they also bring a wealth of experience and expertise that's really necessary to use the data and to interpret the analytical findings. The second bullet highlights that in order for this distributed system to be nimble and efficient, we have to create and test analytic code centrally and then distribute it to each partner to execute against the locally held data. We don't want to waste their time or ask them to modify that code. And then the third bullet just recognizes that this common data model must meet the immediate goals of mini-Sentinel, but it has to be flexible enough to adapt and expand to future imperatives. During the development of the mini-Sentinel common data model, we reviewed several antecedent models, including OMOPS, the HMO virtual data warehouse, vaccine safety data link, and others. And then we also spoke with the data partners about their experiences with these other models. And I've highlighted on this side some themes that emerged from that review process. We were reassured that data partners can assemble the kind of patient-level files according to a common data structure that we need and retain control over their data even while they're working together toward a common objective. As the third bullet there points out, we were reminded yet again that coding schemes do vary across the data partners and that we have to understand and address that variability. And then finally, we concluded that the analytical imperatives of mini-Sentinel could be met using a distributed model. So we began by creating a straw man common data model that really required minimal transformation of source data and then built upon the prior experience of the partners. We went through about a 3-month review process, and with each revision of a common data model, we asked and re-asked the data partners the questions that I've listed here. You know, can you implement these specifications? Is the information specific enough? What have we forgotten? And is this consistent with your expectations? And, of course, FDA was along and reviewing and providing input at every step of the way. Version 1 of the mini-Sentinel common data model does rely on administrative and claims-type data, as Rich mentioned, and includes 5 major data areas that are listed here: enrollment, demographics, outpatient pharmacy dispensing, utilization, and mortality. Now, the initial transformation was a major undertaking, even for highly experienced data partners. Each data partner translated local source data to the common data model structure and format, and then documented that process in a detailed report that was reviewed by the staff at the Operations Center. Questions and issues were discussed on weekly teleconferences and then in one-on-one conversations as well. Once transformed, the data were characterizing using some standard programs that had been developed by the Operations Center. Just to reinforce it, at all times the data remain behind the institutional firewalls and only summary reports are shared with the Operations Center. Overall, the mini-Sentinel distributed database spans from 2000 to 2010, although date ranges do vary by partner. There are nearly 120 million records in the enrollment table, of which about 80% have both medical and drug coverage. Those 120 million records represent about 90 million unique or 70 million, excuse me, unique members. And in terms of what we might consider current members, about 22 million were enrolled with medical and drug coverage as of January 2009. Collectively, there are more than 165 million, 167 million person years of observation time, and on average about 28 months of observation time per member. Now, as you might expect, the proportions of men and women are roughly equal. And about 46 million members, that's about 65%, are between the ages of 20 and 64. Now, although very young children account for a small proportion of enrollees, look at the left side there, this translates really to still about 230,000 children less than 52 weeks of age. And for reference, the 4% of individuals who are aged 85 and older translates to about 3 million. Now, throughout this transformation and characterization process, the Operations Center has been building the infrastructure necessary to support MiniSentinel. This includes the standard programs I mentioned a little bit earlier that characterize and check the quality of the data, but also we undertook a formal assessment of the technical environments at each data partner. We also are working with them to begin preparing for the quarterly data refresh cycles that are beginning now. We've undertaken an empirical assessment so that we can understand data latency and how that varies by data partner. And a key development in the MiniSentinel infrastructure was the development of that secure web portal that Rich mentioned earlier. So as this schematic shows, that portal sits between the Operations Center and the data partner firewalls and provides a secure environment in which to distribute queries and receive the summary results. So the query goes to the portal and then as this suggests, is picked up by the partners. As steps 3 and 4 show, those distributed programs are then executed against the local data sets of that common data model, and then the summary results are returned to the operations committee or center by that secure portal. Again, that's shown in 5 and then the red arrow above. My last minute, I want to touch on a specialized form of distributed programs that we've developed called modular programs. And these are standardized programs designed to facilitate what we consider really quick responses to common questions that are likely to arise from SBA. So the specific inputs change for these programs, but the output is standardized, which really minimizes the review burden on the data partners. In the first year, we've developed and tested these 4 programs listed on this slide. The first one just describes drug exposure for a specific period. The second kind of expands that query to describe exposure among individuals with a specific condition. And then the third program evaluates the rate of a specific outcome or outcomes following some first exposure to a drug of interest. And the fourth characterizes the concomitant use of products among individuals. Thank you again for the opportunity to talk with you today, and I'll turn it over to Devin.
Thanks, Leslie. Devin, are you there? Devin, we don't hear you yet. Try pressing *7 and then speaking. Devin, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
There you are, yes. Go ahead. Thanks.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. I never put myself on mute, but somebody must have done it. Okay, I'm going to talk a bit about what's been done in MiniSentinel to address privacy and security concerns. And the first thing that we need to start out with when you think about addressing privacy and security concerns is a baseline question of whether or not the data uses and the contemplated models are at a minimum compliant with applicable law. And so starting with HIPAA, HIPAA permits disclosure of protected health information to a public health authority for public health surveillance, which includes the safety of FDA-approved products. And we know for sure that FDA is a public health authority, but the definition of public health authority also includes a person or an entity acting under a grant of authority from or contract with the public agency. So the Mini Sentinel Operations Center at Harvard Pilgrim and its subcontractors are all acting under a grant of authority from the FDA, so they fall within this public health authority umbrella. Similarly, the release of PHI, if there is any, which is fairly minimal, as we'll discuss, to the data partners, the Mini Sentinel Operations Center, and the FDA is not research. It's public health practice. So it doesn't require approval by an IRB or a waiver of any consent requirements, and there was a letter issued by the HHS Office of Human Research Protections underscoring that the activities being conducted in Mini Sentinel are public health. So the other federal law that applies here that I think a lot of people forget about are the federal substance abuse treatment regulations, and this is not going to be applicable to all uses of Mini Sentinel because they only apply to federally assisted alcohol or drug abuse treatment programs, but certainly some of the queries may touch those programs. But even then, the laws are only applicable if the information identifies somebody in particular as an alcohol or drug abuser, someone who's applied for or received that kind of treatment. And we've determined that the Part 2 regulations are really unlikely to affect Sentinel, in part because the data that's being shared outside of these treatment programs is done in an aggregate basis and doesn't identify any particular individual. But certainly to the extent that patient-level data is from time to time required for Mini Sentinel, such as to confirm a safety signal, then obviously the data partners are going to have to examine whether the release of that data might implicate these regulations. And then with respect to state laws, they're a little bit all over the map. They commonly require patient consent for the release of identifiable information that falls into the category of genetic test results, mental health information, HIV and communicable diseases. But for the most part, this is regulating external disclosure. Most of these state laws do permit release for public health activities, and to the best of our knowledge, none of them would regulate the release of aggregated information that's not identifiable to a particular patient. But given that we have data sources that exist in different states, it really is an obligation that they have to comply with in terms of examining whether or not they're in compliance with their particular state laws when they share data with as part of Mini Sentinel. So then the last thing I want to discuss are the Mini Sentinel policies, and I was part of a three-person privacy panel that worked with both FDA as well as the Mini Sentinel Operations Center, and I know the data partners were involved in these discussions too. We worked on a set of policies and practices that are based on fair information practices that really, again, the law is a baseline, and the law just typically governs what you can or cannot do with data. It doesn't set forth the particular good practices with data, and I believe Mini Sentinel has really created a good model here. As was mentioned earlier, it's a distributed data model, so the raw data is kept with the data sources and analyzed there. Direct identifiers are removed from any information that's provided to the Operations Center or the FDA. And any identifiable information that a data partner needs to seek and then receive in order to confirm a signal is specifically designated only for use for Mini Sentinel purposes. And then the Operations Center is committed to using the information that it receives only for Mini Sentinel. And then, of course, on the security end, the Operations Center manages security in accordance with the HIPAA security rule and the Federal Information Security Management Act, otherwise known as FISMA. And these policies are available for people to review on the website. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bruce.
Thanks very much, Devin. All the speakers were on mute previously, so Bruce, you'll need to press *7 in order to speak.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, this talk is going to be an overview of our plans for surveillance of acute myocardial infarction in users of diabetes drugs. These plans have been developed with a lot of input from a large team of researchers, from Sentinel's data partners, from FDA, and from academic collaborators. Teams led by Joe Selby, who's a diabetes researcher at Kaiser Permanente. Let's see, I'm trying to advance to the next one here. Where do I do that?
Down in the lower left corner, Bruce, the up-down arrows will advance the slides, but if it doesn't work for you, just tell us and we can advance
them. Okay, I tried that, and I don't see an up-down arrow. I'll try the next time, but otherwise I'll just say next.
Okay.
Okay, our aims. This is a pilot study for sentinel safety surveillance, and as such, our first aim is to develop and assess a framework and infrastructure for monitoring drug safety in large populations using distributed databases. For this pilot effort, our aim is to monitor acute myocardial infarction in users of anti-diabetes drugs. Why AMI in a diabetes study population? Heart attack is a serious outcome of great interest in the diabetes population, and it's an outcome that can be ascertained well by Sentinel's data partners. More specifically, we'll be focusing on the association of heart attack risk with saxagliptin, a recently approved DPP-4 inhibitor. There we go. We'll be monitoring a large dynamic population of adults with type 2 diabetes. Included in our study population will be adults with a diabetes diagnosis and an oral anti-diabetes drug in the 12-month baseline period that we're going to have. So we're going to include people who've been members for 12 continuous months in one of our data partners. There's very few exclusions. We're excluding people with a recent heart attack, very recent heart attack, because they're very high risk in a way that's hard to adjust for. We're also excluding patients who are under age 18 or have been taking only insulin during the baseline period because they're likely to be type 1 rather than type 2 diabetes. Our follow-up period for the study will be from July 2009 through June 2013, with baseline data going back to 2007. This study population will have at least 1.3 million people with type 2 diabetes, and we're anticipating about 47,000 heart attacks in this study population. From this diabetes study population that I've just mentioned, we're going to identify new users of saxagliptin and compare them with new users of four comparator drugs. And these comparators are sitagliptin, pioglitazone, sulfonylurea, and long-acting insulin. Why four comparators? There's no single alternative drug that all saxagliptin users would have been given had they not been given saxagliptin. And there's no single drug whose safety profile can be deemed the gold standard for all these patients. Down here. Follow-up is going to begin at the first prescription of a study drug and end when the user quits the study drug or quits the health plan. And inference is only going to be from new users, followed from first use. So why are we focusing on new users? We're giving something up by doing this. We're doing this to minimize bias, to best be able to address bias from unmeasured confounders. But what we're giving up here is that we won't be making much inference from prevalent users or from on-drug versus off-drug within-person change in MI risk. Our primary outcome is a heart attack identified from hospital discharge diagnoses and also from emergency departments. We'll be picking up people who die in the emergency room or within 24 hours of visiting the emergency room. Most of the heart attacks will be identified from hospital discharge diagnosis of 410. Our secondary outcome is acute coronary syndrome, which includes not only heart attack but also unstable angina. And we'll be examining two kinds of target measures of the drug outcome association. Our primary measure is going to be the relative risk, but we'll also be examining the risk difference. and we'll be examining how both of these measures change over time, mainly time from starting the drug, but also calendar time. A lot of attention of our attention in designing this study is how we're going to adjust for potential confounders. We'll be adjusting for prior cardiovascular disease, demographics, comorbid conditions, concurrent medication use, use of health services, past use of health services, and the site or health plan of our data partner and time, and as I mentioned before, both calendar time and time on study drug. We'll be using several adjustment strategies or methods. First, restriction. We're restricting to new our analyses to new users of the study drugs. Second, stratification. All analyses are going to be stratified by prior cardiovascular disease and by site. Third, covariate adjustment. We're adjusting for a very large number of covariates. And when you've got a large number of covariates, you've got what's often called the curse of dimensionality. And to address the curse of dimensionality, we'll be implementing two types of strategies, a propensity score and, alternatively, a disease risk score. And both the propensity score matching and the disease risk score stratification permit adjustment for covariates without pooling detailed patient-level data. We need only to pool limited amounts of highly de-identified data. I want to mention some of the advantages and disadvantages of propensity score matching and disease risk score matching. The propensity score balances comparisons of new users with the comparative drugs in a way that's intuitive and can be compared to a randomized clinical trial. And when we match one-to-one, we're restricting our comparisons to the best available matches and simplifying the analysis. There are some disadvantages to potential disadvantages. You need a separate propensity score for each pair of study drugs at each site. And especially early on, not much data is available for deriving a propensity score for a new drug like sapsucliptin. There's some advantages to disease risk score stratification in that a single score can be used to compare all the study drugs, and even if uptake is slow at first for sapsucliptin, there's going to be enough data to derive the disease risk score. A lot is known about heart attack risk, and the implications of our confounding adjustment are intuitive. There's also some disadvantages. It's less feasible with rare outcomes, with multiple outcomes, and it's less familiar. Our surveillance is going to be sequential, and the first analysis is going to be soon. It's upcoming. We hope to get it done by the end of March. In the first analysis, we'll examine all the experiences accumulated since the licensure in 2009 of sexagliptin. Then we'll be doing 9 quarterly analyses, monitoring the accumulating data with a final analysis planned for June of 2013. We're going to be adjusting for multiple looks. Each look's going to include all the data that's accumulated to date, and the threshold p-value required for a signal, instead of the usual 0.05, the threshold for at any look will be 0.0144 to ensure that the overall chance of a false signal, of a false positive signal, is below 0.05 across all 10 of the quarterly analyses. I want to say a few words about power and reassurance, about the size of the relative risks that can be detected or ruled out. Our main power calculation assumes that, or was based on the expectation that we're going to accumulate 23,000 person years of follow-up in sexagliptin users and a similar amount in users of each comparator. We expect heart attack incidence of about 9 per 1,000 person years. And if so, we're going to have 61% power to detect a relative risk of, let me just get that up there, 51% power to detect a relative risk of 1.25, 81% power to detect a relative risk of 1.33, and 91% power to detect a relative risk of 1.4. Even if we accumulate only half as much person time as I projected above, then we're still going to have 80% power to detect a relative risk of 1.5. And if all the drugs are safe and no safety signals arise, the confidence intervals are going to be informative about the size of the relative risk and the size of the risk difference that can be ruled out, and about the amount of reassurance that's appropriate. Okay, this pilot study of AMI surveillance is designed to be worthwhile even if saxagliptin is not used as much as we expected when we did that power calculation. Analyses stratified by the proposed heart attack risk score can be used for comparisons among all anti-diabetes drugs, all the drugs that are commonly used in the study population anyway. Comparisons of heart attack risk can yield worthwhile reassurance or alerts about drug safety, lessons about statistical methods for safety surveillance, and evidence of the value of Sentinel's data and infrastructure. And we can learn these things regardless of the saxagliptin uptake. This kind of outcome-centered surveillance is especially promising for outcomes such as heart attack or liver failure or maybe suicide, outcomes that are important to examine in relation to many drugs and in view of the need to monitor drug safety in an uncertain marketplace where we can't always predict the volume of use of new drugs. So in summary, MiniSentinel has developed plans to examine heart attack risk in saxagliptin users versus users of four comparator drugs. We're going to assess the feasibility and value of heart attack surveillance using the distributed databases of Sentinel's data partners. And we're going to be evaluating statistical methods and refining statistical methods for monitoring drug safety in large dynamic populations. Thanks very much.
Bruce, thanks very much for that overview of the MiniSentinel active surveillance protocol for saxagliptin. We have some great questions from the participants. I'm going to turn this over to Josh Benner to go through some of the questions from all of you in just a second. But just to link Bruce's talk back to Judy's remarks about the overall strategy here, Judy, could you start by maybe providing a little bit of insight as to where the decision to start with saxagliptin on this initial active surveillance protocol came from?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So at the outset of the our year one work plan for MiniSentinel, we had identified as acute myocardial infarction as an outcome that we wanted to develop the capability of doing active surveillance. As I mentioned earlier, trying to improve our capability to evaluate, you know, potentially drug-related adverse events that occur commonly in the population, like MI, and do a better job of active surveillance on those products, MI was identified as our initial outcome of interest. So then we went to the new molecular entities or just new drugs that were approved in 2009 so that we could try to get at a new user cohort for a new product. And as we reviewed those drugs that were approved in 2009, saxagliptin was one that, as a member of the group of treatments for diabetes, has a requirement that it have a randomized controlled trial conducted for cardiovascular outcomes as part of its post-approval commitments. And so recognizing that this randomized controlled trial was going to be conducted along the same time frame that we would be doing our active surveillance evaluation, it seemed like a good option because we would ultimately have an RCT to compare the results of our active surveillance evaluation to. So that was the main some of the reasons why saxagliptin and acute MI were selected as the first active surveillance evaluation.
Thanks, Judy. It's Josh here. I'm going to call on a few individuals who have submitted questions online. When I call your name, if you would press star 7 so that your line will come off mute, you can ask your question directly. The first one is from Suzanne Marchione. Suzanne, press star 7 and you'll be able to ask your question.
The question was that the system provides a great deal of information about a very specific subgroup of the population, for instance, adult patients with drug and or medical coverage. And will those limitations be addressed in communicating the information about the risk to the public?
Judy, that one might be best directed to you.
So I think the, you know, certainly when the results of the evaluations are communicated, it'll be made clear what the populations were that were involved in or included in the study population. I think if the question is, are we able to get at other populations, you know, that may be in different situations, I would just refer back to my comment about the federal partners collaboration that includes Medicare and Medicaid populations as well as the Department of Defense and the VA health system. So that gives us access to patients who might be in other situations with regard to health insurance and access to medications. Does that address the question?
It was more along the questions of how consumers or how the public is going to use the information that they get from the FDA website regarding the fentanyl program.
So,
it's going to be made clear to the public that, you know, there are some limitations to this information so that, because I know that one of the things that we want to avoid is false alarms, so that's
right. Okay, so let me, so the way that we envision active surveillance evaluations being used is that they're one more source of information to inform FDA about a particular safety signal. So in the sense of how is FDA using this information, it's taking this information and considering it along with all of the other sources of information that it may have about a given safety issue, whether it comes from the development program or other post-market studies that have been conducted or spontaneous reports, and puts all that information together. And then FDA communicates, excuse me, to healthcare providers and consumers and patients about a particular issue. The information that's posted on the Mini Sentinel website about a particular evaluation will be understood to be one piece of excuse me.
This is Melissa Robb. I can take over. But the information coming from Mini Sentinel evaluations are one piece of information. So trying to balance the idea of transparency and the concern about overwarning is something that the agency is actively thinking about. So we plan to communicate how we currently communicate information about safety issues. And that will include information from many Sentinel evaluations and other evaluations or other information we have about a product through our website. But we're also planning to post the findings from many Sentinel evaluations on minisentinel.org.
Thanks, Melissa. I also want to go to Soledad Cepeda. Soledad, if you're still with us, can you press star 7 and ask your question? It was a good question, so I'll ask it anyway. And this is probably directed at both Melissa and Rich and Judy, if you're still with us. But the question was, how does Mini Sentinel build on the work that's being done in OMOP?
This is Rich. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. we expect to be the primary customers of OMOP. So as OMOP results become available in a form that we can use them, we expect to employ them, and we have an ongoing dialogue with OMOP about being able to do a deeper dive into the OMOP results that are currently available to make sure we understand as clearly as we can the OMOP findings to date so that we can apply them.
Thanks, Rich. Let's go to Steph Reisinger. Steph, if you're there, can you press star 7 and ask your question?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thanks.
Great. So that was a great presentation. My question is really about the saxagliptin protocol. And so we heard about the common data model and some queries. That study going to be performed across the providers on your common data model using standard routines, or how generalizable is it?
Yes, it's going to be performed. Can you hear me? This is Bruce.
Yep, I sure can.
Yeah, it is going to be performed. The study is going to be conducted using the common data model. And the populations served by the data partners are large and somewhat representative, but are certainly big in all. And we will be doing subgroup analyses and reporting on them too. And the limitations of the of our study population will be described and noted when presenting our results.
Thanks, Bruce. There's a question from someone named John whose last name isn't here, but since there are 150 people online, many of whom's name is John, I'm going to go ahead and ask it for him. The question was, is there any way in which FDA currently anticipates making the Sentinel system available to other stakeholders, such as those in academia or the industry? Maybe that's best for Melissa or Judy?
Yeah, so this is Melissa Rabba. I think... for those of you that were at the Sentinel public meeting, Janet Wilcox, who's the director of the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, discussed her vision for an evolving paradigm for this type of national resource for medical product evidence development, including uses for safety and those broader than that, such as comparative effectiveness and quality. So currently, the work being done under MiniSentinel is a contract with Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, but I think we envision one day being at a place where we would have such an infrastructure that could be used for multiple purposes.
Thanks, Melissa. Terry Madison, are you there? If so, press star 7 and go ahead with your question.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes. Hi, Terry.
So I had a question regarding the part on privacy regulations, and I know a question that's come up as an ongoing concern from some of the data owners is, would these data sets be able to be requested through FOIA by various groups? And I know there's been groups in the past, like Public Citizen, that have been tracking, you know, drug safety research done at the FDA level and have requested information. So I don't know if anyone's looked into that aspect of the privacy regulations or releasability of this information.
Maybe a good one for Devin, if you're still with us, Devin.
Yeah, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, so in terms of a FOIA request, it's interesting because the data that comes in, because of the distributed nature of the network and the fact that the data gets analyzed at the data partner level, which are private sector entities subject to HIPAA, but they can't be FOIA'd. Any data that anybody could get through FOIA, assuming it's not subject to an exception under FOIA, is only going to be aggregate data at the most. But whether that, you know, the data in the hands of either the operating center or the FDA, again, the aggregate results, could be subject to FOIA, I think you'd need to get a FOIA lawyer on, because I don't, I'm not the expert. There may be an exception that applies, but it certainly would not be down at the raw data level or the data partner level, I don't think.
Another question from Wanju Dai. Wanju, if you're with us, press star 7 and go ahead.
Yes, my question is regarding the federal health-related electronic data, such as DOD, VA, Medicare. I understand that it will be part of the Sentinel initiative, and I heard many Sentinel included only the commercial databases. So I wonder whether these federal databases will be included in Mini Sentinel in the near future, and what has FDA done with these databases for the Sentinel initiative?
This is Melissa Robb again. As Judy mentioned, we currently have two major pilot activities ongoing, and one of those is Mini Sentinel, which we've been talking about on this call. And then another one is our federal partners collaboration with CMS, DOD, and VA, which Judy referred to also. So those are two different and distinct projects. And I think as the Sentinel system evolves and we work towards creating that, it still needs to be determined how we will be able to integrate data from public and private partners under such a collaboration and if that's possible.
Thanks, Melissa. There's a question from Lourdes Frau. Lourdes, if you're still with us, press star 7 and go ahead. Lourdes, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Actually, I'd rather just address the second part of the question, which is how you're going to address the cost effectiveness of Sentinel.
Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by the cost effectiveness of Sentinel?
Sentinel is obviously going to be costing a few million dollars a year. And the question would be, if you're only analyzing one outcome or two outcomes per year, is this going to be worth the taxpayers' money? And how are we going to evaluate that, in a sense, almost like you evaluate the risk management plan's effectiveness?
So maybe, Melissa, anything you can say about the plans for longer-term sustainability of Sentinel and Mini-Sentinel?
Hi, it's Judy. This is, you know, certainly an issue that we are grappling with. We know that ultimately there are many dozens, if not hundreds, of potential safety questions that we could be addressing through this through eventual Sentinel system, not just around drugs, but vaccines and other biologic products and devices. And so there is certainly a question about scaling up. And, you know, I think the this first year of work has really been about laying a foundation. And year two is going to be about, you know, how do these modular programs run? What can we learn from those? How does the more intensive active surveillance evaluation go, and trying to expand to additional questions. So it's certainly of concern to us, and something that we're trying to plan towards is how do we ultimately scale this up and, you know, create a system that can answer the many, many questions that would benefit from this approach. So, you know, I would say that at least in within the next year or two, we'll be doing an evaluation of the program to date to make sure that it is indeed achieving the goals that we've set out for it. And so this is a continuing process, and one that, you know, fortunately we have many people in the public sector and in the private sector, in academia, and with the help of the Brookings group helping us to try and figure these things out, because it really is creating and developing a science that has not been done on this kind of scale that we envision for it.
Thanks, Judy. There are just a couple more questions here online, so I'll ask our speakers if they can stay with us for another minute or two. There's a question from Stephen Weitzman. Stephen, if you're with us, go ahead. Just press star 7 to unmute your line. Are you there, Stephen? I'll go ahead and ask Stephen's question. Others on the line might be wondering the same. Is the Mini Sentinel partnership open to new participants? Judy or Rich, can you take that one?
Sure. This is Rich. We hope that we'll be able to expand the partnership as we get some stability in our operations and additional resources become available.
Okay, and then the last one we have online is from Dan O'Leary. Dan, if you're there, press star 7 and go ahead.
Yes, I had a I've been at a couple of conferences in which a question about something called a corrective fix pilot has come up, and when people discuss it, they say it's part of signal escalation, which I now understand is part of Sentinel. So I wonder if somebody could discuss this. And basically, my understanding is it primarily deals with revisions to 510K. So it's a device project.
Not sure if anybody, Rich or Judy, is this a familiar topic to you?
No. So surveillance for medical device safety issues is within the scope of the Sentinel initiative, but I can't speak to that particular program because I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Okay, so does anyone on the line, would anyone like to ask a phone-based question? If anyone is not on the internet webinar but would still like to ask a question, we would invite you to do that now by just pressing star and 7.
This is Anna Schaffman. I couldn't get connected to the web. Very interesting presentations. I'm still wondering, putting my hat as a board-certified clinical pathologist and as a former bench scientist, when you are working to get accurate results, you always try to have as many comparators or control as needed. I still cannot understand why we are not adding positive controls and negative controls every time that we are assessing data, because things, working with data intensively, I understand, how easy it is to make mistakes. Then it will add another level of assurance that the right results are obtained, because the positive are acting as positive, the negatives are acting as negative.
Maybe Rich, do you have any thoughts on that?
It's a terrific question, and we're trying to balance sort of the completeness up front against the workload that it imposes. And so one approach that we've adopted is in the interest of moving these protocols ahead to have a staged approach whereby if we see a signal, among the things we do is test test negative controls in that environment, choosing the negative controls in a way that we think would most challenge the association that we observe, because the specific challenge might differ given the particular kind of signal that we see. But we're sort of rapidly evolving a set of standard operating procedures that deal just with that question.
Can I ask another question?
I have to be real quick, Anna. We're running a bit over.
Yes. It's very important from my experience to be able to, for people to access the same data and using the same tools, because mistakes are made when you are handling such complex data. And I think that the auditability is critical for us to understand if the results are the right results, drilling down to the raw data behind the results is also very critical, because I have seen patients classify as not receiving warfarin, for example, and they were because they were misclassified. This is in clinical trial data. But it's a comment.
Rich, any thoughts on that?
Well, with regard to reproducibility, I want to emphasize that all of the analyses that we're posting the programs that underlie all of our analyses on the website, so they'll be available for everyone to look at and help us find problems with the code if that exists. We have the capability of going to original medical records when we need to do that to confirm exposures and outcomes in the event that we see a signal and need to confirm it.
Great. Thanks very much. I'd like to conclude just by thanking all of our distinguished speakers for their input, especially Judy under adverse conditions. Thank you. Thank you all. And also all of you who participated. You have some great questions and a great discussion. I think this is kind of illustrates the value of this webinar approach. Our next webinar is going to be in March. We'll be sending out an announcement about that in the next few weeks, and we look forward to your participation in our future events and on these very important issues around post-market evidence. I hope you all have a great afternoon, and take care.
Thank you.